You're listening to the Author Stories Podcast, bringing you the story behind the stories and the storytellers.
Margaret Wise,
Terry Brooks,
Sheena Kamal,
Matthew Quick,
J.T. Ellison,
Walt D. Williams,
Brad Thor,
Corey Doctorow,
Brandon Sanderson,
Robin Mom,
Ernest Klein, Jim Butcher,
Sherilyn Harris.
Visit HankGarner.com for archives of all the shows. Today's guest is
Jason Pinter.
Writers, I have an amazing tool to tell you about. A revolutionary writing tool for planning stories, Campfire Pro is what novelists need to go from the seed of an idea to a detailed plan that's ready to be executed. Complete your character design, create a timeline, and track your world building all in one place with our downloadable desktop app for Mac and PC. Without the annoying subscription model so many apps are using today, visit campfiretechnology.com for special holiday pricing on Campfire Pro today. Authors, I have a fantastic new service to tell you about. It's called PubSite. PubSite is a service to help you build your very own website, your home on the web, where you can promote your work and give your fans a place to connect with you. PubSite is a website platform that allows every author, regardless of budget, to have a great-looking professional website. Developed by the book marketing professionals at FSB Associates, PubSite is the new, easy-to-use DIY website builder developed specifically for books and authors. Whether you're an author of one book or 20, or a small publisher, PubSite allows you to build, design, and most importantly, update your website pain-free. No need to be dependent on a designer or webmaster to make a small but costly change to your website. Save the money and do it yourself. PubSite is the best platform for authors because it's a book-centric platform. PubSite was built just for authors and small publishers. Every design, feature, and layout is book-centric. They have customized designs for you to use. It's easy to build. No coding or HTML is necessary to create a stunning, professional-looking website with all the features you want. Get a custom domain name, yourname.com. It's simple to update. You can add all of your books, add a blog and a book tour, sell from any retailer, manage your email list and social media, and even do e-commerce. Build your website with a 14-day free trial, then pay just $19.99 per month, which includes hosting. And we offer packages starting at $499 to set up the website for you. Pub-site.com, the place to help authors find their home on the web. The Feisty Heroine Romance Collection of Short Stories. Over 30 plus pulse racing shorts to capture your heart with USA Today, The Wall Street Journal, New York Times, and award-winning authors in the mix. Paranormal, contemporary, fantasy, and historical romance that will whet your appetite with titillating, heart-pounding tales you'll want to read again, then beg for more. Fall in love with your next book crush. Pre-order this amazing collection of shorts, over 30 pulse-pounding stories, for only 99 cents.
Proceed with caution. Buying this collection may lead to addictive reading, falling in love with your next book crush, and staying up past your bedtime to see what happens next.
Get your limited edition copy of Feisty Heroines. Look for the link in the show notes of this episode. Well, thanks for joining me again for the Author Stories Podcast, where I bring you the story behind the stories and the storytellers. Today, I'm super excited to have Serena Kent on the show with me today, and her brand new book, Death in Avignon, is the second Penelope Kite mystery book, and you guys are really going to love this. Now, Serena Kent is actually a co-writing duo, a husband and wife that joined together to write this series. And the husband is Robert Rees and Deborah Lawrenson. And welcome to the show, guys.
Thank you. Nice to
see you.
We begin each show with the same question, and that question is, what is your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller? Deborah, why don't we start with you?
Gosh, I was one of those kids who was writing stories in exercise books when I was about 8 or 9. and never got beyond the first chapter, which I seemed to have the whole story in it. And then I think when I was leaving university, I thought I would love to be a writer, but I really didn't have the confidence to do it. I didn't have the connections. I didn't have the story. Let's face it, I was very young. And so I then went and trained as a journalist. I worked as a journalist in London and gradually thought, right. In fact, actually, no, the truth of the matter is that Rob bought me a computer, for my 30th birthday, and said, right, all these years talking about writing a book, get on with it.
One of my more sensible gifts.
Right. To be honest. Well, it's better than an iron or a vacuum cleaner.
Exactly.
That would have done well as well.
No, it wouldn't.
It was actually more lucrative, so I'm very happy about
yeah,
it.
Yeah,
absolutely.
I did write the first novel, and I did get it published fairly quickly. Yeah. And I think I wrote the second one on that computer as well, didn't I? So there you go. Well done, Rob.
It is still up in the attic somewhere.
I love it. Well, we're going to come back to those early novels, Deborah, in just a minute. But let's hear from Rob. What was your first memory of wanting to be a writer or storyteller?
Yeah, absolutely nothing ever attaching close to writing. I mean, I was a great reader, and I love language. I've always loved language, but I ended up in the city, so I did something completely different. But the bit I loved in the city was the writing of the various prospectuses and things that I had to do, which was quite exact, but had to be very perfect. I'm a musician, so I've always loved the rhythm and the lyricism of language. And actually, funnily enough, like me and Debbie the other way, I had an idea, and Deborah said, well, for God's sake, you know, don't talk about it, do it. So when I'd finished my main job, I started writing a novel of mine, which wasn't particularly good, but I enjoyed doing it. And it had some funny stuff in it. And on the basis of that rather weak sort of conjecture, Deborah decided that she might possibly work with me, even though she's much more successful than I am, obviously. But I mean, it was quite a compliment, really.
Well, I think, you know, let's get the story straight here, Rob. Rob loves working in our house in France. I don't particularly. That's my holiday. But he got really stuck into this first book he was writing. And I'd come into the kitchen where we have a long table and family life goes on. And I'd see him crashing away on the laptop, laughing uproariously at his own jokes. Mm. And then I said, you know, how's it going? And he said, well, you know, it's funny. I never realized it was so easy. 5,000 words since breakfast. Who knew I was this talented? So clearly I needed to rein that in a bit. And I just thought, well, if the man is a writing force to be reckoned with, I might as well harness him to a project myself.
I think competition is a very important thing. And I wouldn't say we competed sort of face to face, but we did, yes. I mean, I did enjoy telling Debbie that I'd done 1,000 words before breakfast when she'd only done 500 of hers.
But 500 quality words.
Yes,
Rob,
exactly. And when she had corrected mine and corrected the spelling, in fact, when my daughter had corrected the spelling and told me I was the most useless English writer in the history of the language, but the jokes were quite funny. That sort of yeah, that's how it coalesced. So actually, I'm quite pleased in a way that Debbie asked me to write with her.
Absolutely.
Well, changed it all anyway.
Well, you know. You've got a professional on the case.
Yeah, exactly. It's good to have someone that knows what they're talking about, you know.
Joking apart, we have had a lot of fun writing these books, as I hope will come across. And, you know, we've been doing talks in England about how to write a murder mystery with your spouse without actually committing one. Because believe me, it gets quite heated, doesn't it?
From time to time.
Yes.
Oh, that's so funny. That's so funny. Deborah, what types of books were you writing alone when you had that phenomenal success due to Rob's gift to you?
Well, the first two books were actually funny books as well. They were based on my time working on a famous gossip column on a Fleet Street newspaper, a national newspaper in London. And it was fine. They got published by Random House. And then I wrote another black comedy. And after that, our daughter was born, and I decided I wanted to write really the kind of book that I wanted to write all along, which was a more literary novel with themes and proper examination of life under the surface, which has always fascinated me. And to that end, I wrote a book called The Art of Falling, which was a semi-historical novel, well, near history, set in Italy in the Second World War. And I worked incredibly hard on it, and I sent it to my agent, my usual agent, and he said, "Oh, it's different from your other books." And I said, "Yeah, but it's better, isn't it?" Mm. And he said, "Yeah, okay, but I don't like it." Anyway, a long story short, I ended up on my own in the wilderness, and I had another top agent took it on, couldn't place it. And anyway, I had a long, hard look at it about 4 years later, and I just thought, well, I could write something else, but I don't think I can write anything better. So I decided to self-publish it. And this was back at the time when it was a question of printing 2,000 copies. No. And I got some great reviews. Up, yeah. I mean, I went to huge lengths to package it right so that it looked really professional.
Which it did. Yeah.
And we sort of started a little publishing company so that I could ring round people and say, "Oh, it's a tiny new publishing company run by Rob's brother." Eventually it came out. I got some great reviews, and in fact, Random House in London republished it, and it did incredibly well. And so that set. So yes, it was a summer bestseller in England, and that set me on the path of writing semi-historical but present-day novels. What my agent calls latte lit, so literary novels, but not light commercial literary novels, but hopefully well written and something to think about.
Yeah, I have to say it's a great book, actually. The Art of Falling is my favourite.
Yeah, but it wasn't published in America.
But it wasn't published in America.
Yeah. Anybody can get a copy?
There's still time, yeah.
And
they're rare now. But it's a wonderful book, actually, and that sort of set you on your course.
Yes.
And there were a number of very, after Random House, there were a number of very good deals.
Well, no, in America, The Lantern was my my breakout novel in the US, for which I am phenomenally grateful. Mm. And in fact,
To HarperCollins and Stephanie.
Then the first Serena Kent, The Death in Provence book is also the same team that did the more serious Lantern. Mm. So, but this is quite different.
So you were writing latte literature, as you put it. Rob is trying his hand at writing. What brings the two of you together to say, "Hey, let's write together a lighthearted mystery," kind of a almost tongue-in-cheek version of of Agatha Christie. Not really tongue in cheek,
but it's a good description.
I love Agatha Christie, and I wish I was as good as she was.
Agatha Christie, one critic in Britain said it's a cross between Agatha Christie and Peter Mayle, who wrote the Provence books. But anyway,
I think a couple of things. I've always wanted. I worked in a bank, and I enjoyed it terrifically. But actually, you know, to be honest, I prefer writing, music, and stuff like that. One of my mentors at the bank said, you know, you are so out of what a proper banker should be. God knows how you got there. But I carried on, and you know, made some money, so that was all right. And anyway, so having done that. I started off in another course, and I used to write a lot of music. I write a lot of plays, and you get practiced. You become better, and I can't say I'm nearly as hot a writer as Debbie, but I'm good at dialogue, and I'm good at lyrics, and you know, I'm good at beat, the rhythm of words. And so anyway, we were sitting on our terrace in the south of France, probably having a glass of wine.
As you do.
Must have been after 6 o'clock. And and saying, you know, what are we going to do with this? We've had this house for a while. You know, what are we going to do? We can't make any money out of this house, and it's a money pit. So what should we do? And, you know, option one was rent it. And option two, which our daughter came up with, actually, I think, at one point, said, well, just write a book, you know, write a funny book. And it was, I think, originally going to be Deborah and my daughter Madeline were going to write a funny book. And then Deborah, with great sort of character, actually, because it's not easy to do, said, well, why didn't you help me, Rob?
Write
the funny stuff and the dialogue. And it is funny. I mean, we have different gifts in this, and so we said right, okay, let's write a comic, nice, gentle murder mystery, but set in the, you know, complicated a la Agatha Christie, but set in Provence, because Peter Mayle did it all right, or Peter Mayle did well with his books, and you know, why not try and do the similar thing? And I've lived in Provence in the summer, both with my family and with Debbie, and, you know, now for years and years. I mean, probably every single year of my life, I have been to Provence. So I knew the area tremendously well. I knew the ambiance and the colour and the beauty of it, and I love it. And so it was another nice way of getting over that feeling for it. And touch wood, you know, making a bit of money as well. We didn't expect to make anything at all. We were going to put it out on ebook, but luckily, Debbie's agents are the best in the world, and both came back saying, we absolutely love it, and here are two deals, one in the UK and one in the US. So, you know, it sort of worked rather well.
Yeah.
Better than I thought.
But also, I have to say that I do think that the fun that we had inventing these characters... Mm. It really was quite organic how they grew, and so much so that, you know, when we wrote the second book, Death in Avignon, that's out today, it really did feel as if the characters were embedded, and it's a character driven plot as well as a mystery.
That's one of the great things about. That's one of the great things about having a series of books, is that you can develop the character as well as the story. So hopefully you have a good story each time, but the characters can get deeper and more fun, actually. And also, after a while, they almost start creating their own story. Mm. You sit there at the desk and think, you know, what would they say at this particular juncture? And they actually create themselves.
That's when you know you've got a great character, when you can sit back and you know, for lack of a better term, watch what they do, and it just kind of erupts from there.
You know what they're going to say, which the funniest, you know, that's the best bit, and that's actually the bits, the sort of dialogue and the descriptions, the bits that work the best at the bits where you whack it down in about half an hour, thinking that's exactly what they're going to say. That's what they like. And I think that's great fun.
Well, quite a few of them, it has to be said, quite a lot of the characters are loosely based on real people. Their genesis definitely was in friends and acquaintances. So, for example, Monsieur Sharpe is very similar to the gardener at your father's house.
He is exactly the same person. And a well-loved and lovely man who was, I mean, he must have been about 100 years old, even when we knew him in about 1970, but it's sort of wizened, you know, skin, sort of olive-skinned, wizened chap who was very French, very French indeed, even looked French, or looked like Asterix, you know. And he had that wonderful French way of being terribly nice, but doing exactly what he wanted, whether you asked him to do it or not. So when we said to the garden, you know, put these things there, he would put some roses where we asked him, but then plant cabbages in lines between them.
Aubergines.
Aubergines, sorry. Because he thought it was a waste of land, and the most delightful man, actually. And funnily enough, the current chap who we have, who is only about 25 or something, 28, is exactly the same. You know, he says yes to us, he agrees with us, he says he'll do what we want,
and we get tomatoes,
and then we get tomatoes in the middle of our, and it's yeah, I love them.
Yeah, it's great. And Françoise was our estate agent. So she is absolutely Clémence Valincourt.
Perfectly
formed,
yeah.
Blonde, chic. We know we will never aspire to. And
a lot of Chanel. It's a lot of Chanel. There,
and tiny.
Yeah.
And very forceful.
Thin.
Yeah, well, thin. Yeah. Unlike us. So yes, we very much took real life and had a lot of fun embroidering it and over dramatizing it and killing a few people along the way in the nicest possible taste. So
that's how it goes.
So yeah.
When you guys first had this ingenious idea, let's just write a book that's fun and it's just a passion project and there's no strings attached to it. And there's absolutely nothing wrong with being a working writer and knowing that your livelihood comes from that. We endorse that. We hope people can do that, but there's something different about, a story that just comes out of just pure joy and there are no expectations on it. Did you ever imagine that it would come out as good as it did?
No.
I mean, it's interesting. It's interesting you say that because, yeah, we had absolutely no expectations whatsoever. And actually it was Deb's agents that sort of, you know, took it, sort of ripped it from our hands and provided us with some money, which was wonderful. But
the point was,
we would have still done it. If there'd been nothing of that, we would have put it out on ebook and bought enough for a few trees and whatever, a bit of gardening or something. But you know, actually, it was immensely good fun to do it, and it still is. And there's something about writing, especially, I think, to be honest, you know, we're not Dostoevsky, so it's sort of, you know, it's, you know, about comic writing, which is just immensely good fun. And if you make someone laugh, as I write the pantomime every year here, and every moment you write one gag and no one laughs, and then you write another gag which you thought was rubbish and everyone laughs, and it's just the best feeling ever. I mean, it cannot be better than that, in my opinion.
Although, actually, I don't think, in general, I mean, I didn't write these books as comic novels.
No,
they were written as cosy mysteries, but with a twist of humour.
Yeah.
And hopefully warmth as well, because that was really important.
Yeah.
That actually Penelope Kite is a woman of 50, newly divorced, and actually it's an optimistic and warm book about the possibilities for a woman who's suddenly alone at 50 in a strange but beautiful land and what happens to her and how she conducts herself. So beneath the authentic descriptions of Provence and the jolly conversations, there's actually a seam of narrative that is showing how Penelope conducts herself, how she bit by bit makes friends, she fits into the local village, and there's actually quite a lot of insider information about how that happens.
You can see who's the sort of proper writer here and who's the gag writer.
Well, I'll tell you guys what I
gags and silly situations.
So you say, Rob. So you say.
And Debbie's good on sort of knitting it all together and making it.
Well, I'll tell you guys what I thought when I was reading Death in Avignon, and I'm going back and getting the first book because I loved it so much. But one thing, when I found out that you guys were a married couple writing together, and I don't want to give the impression that the comedy in this book is slapstick by any means. It's a very wry sense of humor, and what I got was my wife and I have been married for 25 years, and we have
we
do, and you know, the thing when people ask us, you know, what's the, you know, the secret to your relationship, or, you know, magic or whatever, and I tell people it's to have a sense of humor and to be able to make each other laugh. And hands down, above all of the other things that we do well together, we make each other laugh. And when I read this book, I said, these people love each other and can make each other laugh. It's just, it's a subtext to the writing.
And I'm glad you thought it, because it's absolutely true. And we did, we had an enormous amount of fun doing it, mainly sort of just, you know, whacking the scenes from between each other, or, you know, making up stuff or thinking what happens next. And it starts off very free form and then gradually comes together. The only point at which I would say that you're wrong is that we had about 2 weeks before the end, you know, where you really have to go through these things word by word and decide, you know, what is the right word and what is the wrong word, and what,
how
what
it
works,
hangs together,
how it hangs together, everything like that. That was possibly the tensest moment of the last 30 years of our marriage. And that had to be, you know, it got to the point where either one of us would say, I think we may have to go for a cup of tea.
Yep. Or
I'll go on a walk and I'll come back. And the awful
thing is,
and
I don't want to hear another word about that.
The awful thing is, and I'm sure you have the same thing, is that you get to the point where you actually think, actually, I'm going to say something annoying and irritating and wrong just in order to actually irritate the person next to me, because she's won something and therefore I've got to get something back. And luckily that didn't happen too often. But, yeah, that was an interesting period. You learn a lot about life at that point.
Yeah, but it was all very British. And you think, I think it's
very
time
reserved
for tea, for gritted tea. Would you like one?
Yes. Yeah. Yeah, that was
to calm down.
It was definitely English. Yes, Woodhousian.
Well, you can't have all roses. Sometimes you need some cabbages between.
I know. Sometimes people need the last word, and as you know.
There's
one person who leaves the last word.
That's right. That's right. Rob, I know that you are a musician, and that's a passion of yours. And you've mentioned several times in our talk here that rhythm is very important to you. You're very conscious of rhythm. In a co-writing relationship, rhythm is very important in how you pass the thing back and forth, and who attributes what. What is your co-writing relationship? How do you physically share in the writing, and is that rhythm important to you, to know when to play, when to rest, and that sort of thing?
Good question. Actually, I think let's get this right. Deborah's got the most fantastic writing, you know, sort of.
In the words,
you know, we both write. I write good dialogue because I've written a lot of plays and things, and I know how it, and lyrics actually, song lyrics, and so I know how words work. Deborah writes them because she's a brilliant writer in English, and you know, so she knows how words work, and she's a great poet as well. She understands poetry. So we both come from the same end there. And we've never had, actually, to be honest, we have never had an argument, I think, about dialogue at all. We've had arguments about, you know, sort of description,
details.
Oh, punctuation.
Rough doesn't punctuation, do details.
Yeah, no. Yeah, but, you know, that's...
Bit
that's,
of a handicap when it's a complicated murder mystery.
I feel that's secondary. But the point is that, you know, we've had details about description and plot exposition and things like that. We've never had an argument about the way people speak. And the way people speak in these sort of dialogue-heavy books is very, very important. So I think that in that respect, we haven't. In our sort of approach, we approach it from slightly different angles. I mean, because Deborah's a proper writer and I'm a purveyor of fun. So, you know, it sort of comes from a different angle. But you see, the great thing is that I give her a situation, and if she laughs, then it goes in. And if she says rubbish, then I don't.
I think what Hank was also asking about rhythm was how you knit together two people's work. Mm-hmm. Is that right?
Yes.
Interesting.
So,
and who gets to contribute what?
Well, at the beginning, because I'm fairly confident about how to stitch a book together, we just have fun with it. So we discuss the plot, and Rob says, well, I'd quite like to go and write the bit at Apt Market or whatever. And I say, great. And so he goes and does that. I'll go and write something else. And really, the first draft is just these separate episodes that we've written.
We added together, yeah.
Added together. So we write fairly autonomously at the beginning. Mm. So there will be definitely what I've written, what Rob's written, and actually it's my job to come along and try and put them together, seamlessly. And then we'll sort of probably like... a dressmaker will make a rough pattern first of all, and just sort of stitch up so that you get something that hangs together. And then we argue and I edit it and polish so that it seems seamless.
To be fair, I mean, Debbie does the polishing. I mean, we had a very nice, I mean, we had actually a similar question from someone in England recently, and saying, I can't tell there are no joins in the book. There doesn't seem to be a point where, you know, sort of one person finishes and one person started, which I took as a great compliment. It's probably because Debbie's written the whole thing without telling me, but
you know, you didn't notice.
I never noticed detail, apparently.
Yeah, right.
I hope. And I think, you know, I'm writing hoping that it actually hangs together as you know, as one work.
It's definitely one singular voice.
There's no great difference in style or sort of pace or anything during the book, I don't think.
Right.
I may be wrong. It's also been very well edited by our wonderful editors and indeed by Deborah.
It's definitely a singular voice.
Oh, that's great. Well, yeah. I'm glad you think that, because so do I. I mean, I couldn't even tell the bits I wrote, frankly, when I read it. probably none of them.
It's
a completely different book.
But you're very proud of it.
That's so funny.
Bits of dialogue, yeah.
So we've talked about this great cast of characters that you've got, and absolutely from the mayor... and the estate agent, and these fully formed characters that you, when you drop into the story, it feels like you know them. And that comes from, from really taking time and getting into the characters. And you said that a lot of them were based on people you knew or had observed. What about Penelope Kite? Where did Penelope come from?
I have to defer.
Well, hate to say it, but there's quite a lot of autobiography in Penelope from my point of view. Character-wise, she's quite similar. I would like to think that I would be that brave and going off on my own. Mm. I don't know. Mm. But she's maybe what I would quite like to be like in a different life. Mm. Does that on?
I think she's the main character, isn't she? And she's the one. My job was basically providing characters against which she could rub, sort of favourably or unfavourably. So Frankie, who's a sort of larger than life mad English lapper, she was my idea. But the fun is in the actual what would they do together and what would happen and why are they such friends, and things like that. So I think there are elements of actually, of course, there are elements of both our character in that. And actually, to move back slightly in my only novel, my first one, the main character obviously had a lot of me in it as well. But generally, you pull in character traits of some friends and things you like about things you like about or don't like about people. And it's never you. It's never a straightforward. This is Penelope is not Deborah. But there are certain elements which are quite similar.
I think her reaction
and her ex-husband is not me.
No.
Even though he was a lawyer in the city, funnily enough.
No. I mean, yes, Penelope, what Penelope says, I think, are the kind of things that how I would react to the same
events. The embarrassments are similar, aren't they? The embarrassment of being caught doing some sort of keep fit tape by the mayor in some leggings or something like that. That was definitely Deborah. I mean, that was,
Not
the embarrassment was real. And I like to think of myself as Laurent the Mayor, the cool French bloke.
Yeah, right.
He is hopeful.
And the ever-present struggle against patisserie.
That's true, yeah.
That's true,
From both of us.
Yeah, being in France and too much lovely food and slightly too much temptation on the wine front. We have to be very careful.
But the love of the land and the love of the place is actually, that's actually from both of us. But I mean, Deborah came to stay in my father's house in about 5 miles down the road from where we now have a house. In about the mid 70s. 80s, sorry, mid 80s.
Details.
So we go back an awful long way there, and I have it's not quite a home from home, but it nearly is. I love it dearly, and I love the people. I think they're terribly nice people. You forget that it's the real country. We don't all live in the real country. This is a real country.
Well, I love it, and it bleeds through on the page how much you love this place, and it's infectious almost. The place, the people, it's the whole package. Death in Avignon is available everywhere today. It's the second Penelope Kite mystery, and do you think there are more adventures for Penelope to get into?
I think so, because there's plenty of places to go with the characters and Penelope, and a lot more development that we could explore,
which we have started exploring, we'll wait and see. I think it's great when you get a set of people that, as I said earlier on, they almost create their own repartee. They almost create their own dialogue because the characters so well that you know exactly what they're going to say, given the situation. All you have to do, obviously, is come up with an interesting situation that's a bit more difficult, but I know exactly what they're going to say when presented with it.
When told,
exactly what to say. And then being told not to say that.
we look forward to many more adventures with Penelope. Death in Avignon is available everywhere today. There are links to it in the show notes of this episode. Rob and Debbie, if people are have fallen in love with you and want to dig into all of the stuff that you do, is there a place online where they can connect with you?
Yeah, we've got a Serena Kent website. It's quite a basic one, I've also got a website, a Deborah Lawrenson website, with slightly more of that. And anybody who wants to see blog posts about Provence, I've had a blog for many years since The Lantern came out, and I've posted up just photos and little snippets and little bits of information and little stories about Provence, and that is still up there. It's a blogger site, but you can find it through my website.
And Serena Kent's on Facebook as well.
And I've got.
I always answer every question you meet.
Oh yes, Rob does a terrific job as Serena on Facebook, and I have a Serena Instagram account. So Serena Instagram, follow for a glimpse into Penelope's Provence.
Oh, and your Instagram is fantastic. A walk through Provence, and it's amazing.
He's got a great sense of composition and picture.
Absolutely. Okay. Absolutely.
Some of them are mine.
Of course. Yeah. Rob and Debbie, this has been so much fun talking. Thank you so much for taking time to come on the show.
Oh, thanks for having us, Hank.
Thank you. Good luck.
And have a waiter bring him a martini, which he would down before he hit the...
Stay tuned now for an audiobook excerpt from Richard Fox's The Ember War.
Future humanity,
structure of story and things like that, but I really enjoyed the creative process.
The probe slowed as the sun's heliosphere disrupted the graviton wave it rode in on from the abyss of deep space. Awakened by the sudden deceleration, the probe absorbed the electromagnetic spectrum utilized by its target species and assessed the technological sophistication of the sole sentient species on Earth. The probe adjusted its course to take it into the system's primary. If the humans couldn't survive, with its help, what was to come? Then the probe would annihilate itself. There would be no trace of it for the enemy, and no chance of humanity's existence beyond the time it had until the enemy arrived. The probe analyzed filed patents, military expenditures, birth rates, mathematical advancement, and space exploration. The first assessment fell within the margin of error of survival and extinction for humanity. The probe's programming allowed for limited, autonomous decision-making, choice being a rare luxury for the probe's class of artificial intelligence. The probe found itself in a position to choose between ending its mission in the sun's fire and a mathematically improbable defense of humanity, and the potential compromise of its much larger mission. Given the rare opportunity to make its own decision, the probe opted to dither. In the week it took to pass into Jupiter's orbit, the probe took in more data. It scoured the internet for factors to add to the assessment, but the assessment remained the same. Unlikely, but possible. By the time it shot past Mars, the probe still hadn't made a decision. As the time to adjust course for Earth or continue into the sun approached, the probe conducted a final scan of cloud storage servers for any new information. And found something interesting. While the new information made only a negligible impact on the assessment, the probe adjusted course to Earth. It hadn't traveled all this way for nothing. In the desert south of Phoenix, Arizona, it landed with no more fanfare than a slight thump and a few startled cows. Then it broke into the local cell network and made a call. Mark Ibarra awoke to his phone ringing at max volume, playing a pop ditty that he hated with vehemence. He rolled off the mattress that lay on the floor and crawled on his hands and knees to where his cell was recharging. His roommate, who paid the majority of their rent and got to sleep on an actual bed, grumbled and let off a slew of slurred insults. Mark reached his cell and slapped at it until the offending music ended. He blinked sleep from his eyes and tried to focus on the caller's name on the screen. The only people who'd call at this ungodly hour were his family in Basque country, or maybe Jessica in his applied robotics course wanted a late-night study break. The name on the screen was Answer Me. He closed an eye and reread the name. It was way too early, or too late, depending on one's point of view, for this nonsense. He turned the ringer off and went back to bed. Sleep was about to claim him when the phone rang again, just as loudly as last time, but now with a disco anthem.
Seriously?
His roommate slurred. Mark declined the call and powered the phone off. He flopped back on his bed and curled into his blanket.
To hell with my first class,
he thought. Arizona State University had a lax attendance policy, one which he'd abused for nights like this. The cell erupted with big band music. Mark took his head out from beneath the covers and looked at his phone like it was a thing possessed. The phone vibrated so hard that it practically danced a jig on the floor, and the screen flashed Answer Me over and over again as music blared.
Dude,
said his roommate, now sitting up in his bed. Mark swiped the phone off the charging cord, and the music stopped. The caller's name undulated with a rainbow of colors, and an arrow appeared on the screen, pointing to the button he had to press to answer the call.
When did I get this app?
He thought. Mark sighed and left the bedroom, meandering into the hallway bathroom with the grace of a zombie. The battered mattress he slept on played hell with his back and left him stiff every morning. Dropping his boxers, he took a seat on the toilet and answered the call, determined to return this caller's civility with some interesting background noise.
What?
He murmured. Mark Ibarra, I need to see you. The voice was mechanical, asexual in its monotone.
Do you have any friggin' idea what time it is? Wait, who the hell is this?
You must come to me immediately. We must discuss the mathematical proof you have stored in document title This Can't Be Right. Doc.
Mark shot to his feet. The boxers around his ankles tripped him up, and he stumbled out of the bathroom and fell against the wall. His elbow punched a hole in the drywall, and the cell clattered to the floor. He scooped the phone back up and struggled to breathe as a sudden asthma attack came over him.
How?
He couldn't finish his question until he found his inhaler in the kitchen, mere steps away in the tiny apartment. He took a deep breath from the inhaler and felt the tightness leave his lungs. That someone knew of his proof was impossible. He'd finished it earlier that night and had encrypted it several times before loading it into a cloud file that shouldn't have been linked to him in any way.
How do you know about that?
He asked.
You must come to me immediately. There is little time. Look at your screen, the robotic voice said. His screen changed to a map program, displaying a pin in an open field just off the highway, connecting Phoenix to the suburb of Maricopa.
Come. Now. Mark grabbed his keys. An hour later, his jeans ripped from scaling a barbed wire fence, Mark was surrounded by desert scrub.
The blue of the morning rose behind him, where his beat-up Honda waited on the side of the highway. With his cell to it,
some things you write now, do they differ in the writing process from
plants? Looked a lot like benign mesquite trees in the darkness. A Native American casino in the distance served as his North Star, helping him keep his bearings.
"You're not out here, are you? I'm being punked, aren't I?"
he asked the mysterious caller. "You are 9.26 meters to my east-southeast. Punk, decayed wood, used as tinder. Are you on fire?" the caller said. Mark rolled his eyes. This wasn't the first time the caller had used the non-standard meanings of words during what passed as conversation between the two. Mark had tried to get the caller to explain how he knew about his theorem and why they had to meet in the middle of the desert. The caller had refused to say anything. He would only reiterate that Mark had to come quickly to see him, chiding him every time Mark deviated from the provided driving directions.
"If you're so close, why can't I see you?" he asked.
He took a few steps in what he thought was a northwesterly direction and squished into a cow paddy.